October 2011. This is the Hermetic Hour, and I am your host, Poke Runyon. Now, tonight we'll have a lively and controversial discussion on a recent aspect of the magical revival called old school magic. Now, tonight we're having a lively and controversial discussion on a recent aspect of the magical revival called old school magic. And this is a development that came about after the 1990s revival of Solomonic magic following the publication of Don Craig's Modern Magic and our book and video on the source of the invocation methods that Craig described. And Steve Savdo's Goetic Evocation came out at the same time, representing a more medieval approach to the same operation. In very simple terms, we can say that we are, or were, reviving Solomon's ceremonial magic on a Renaissance Neoplatonic Hermetic model. It seemed that Stephen Skinner and Joseph Leswiski seemed intent on reviving it on a Judeo-Christian model, attempting to recreate a medieval dualistic mindset, or at least what they thought was a medieval dualistic mindset. Now, I don't say all this critically, because an earlier mindset, Joseph Lichevsky, I think it's spelled Lichevsky, but it's pronounced Lichevsky, I think, calls a subjective synthesis, I love that term, is absolutely necessary for these operations to work. And whether one uses hypnotic conjuration devices or tries for free-floating manifestations, you will naturally supernaturalize yourself in the course of this work. But you can choose to go 500 years ago or 1,000 years ago. Now, we should recall that the Hermetic writings were not available in direct form to medieval magicians. They were available in indirect form. And yet, Renaissance magicians were steeped in Hermetic monist solipsistic philosophy, and that's Ficino and Pico della Mirandola and the Italian Renaissance, and these guys were very, very heavy-duty scholars. Now, they were intent on reviving medieval ceremonial magic, but where the medievalists had conjured in smoke, the Renaissance magi preferred crystals and dark mirrors, and that's a little controversial. We'll get into that. We're going to delve into these different approaches and perhaps discover that the old school has a good point to make. In the Middle Ages, they believed in God, and they believed in miracles, and so that is a very effective mindset for ceremonial magic. Now, of course, if you like that, and if you need that kind of mindset, then you could also join the SCA and enjoy an idealized revival of medieval culture. Otherwise, of course, we will see you at the Ren Fair. Good morrow, lords and ladies. Anyway, this is a complex subject, and it's a complex subject that does ruffle a few feathers, and we're going to try to get through this in an informative sort of way. Let me say this to start with. When I came up with my discovery or rediscovery of using the magic mirror in the triangle and using it in Solomonic Goetic operations back in 1969, now, I was not at that time one of these people that was all steeped in the Golden Dawn and the OTO and Theosophy and all of that sort of thing, and Victorian and bric-a-brac and whatever. I didn't have a background in that at all. All I knew when I came up with this was what I'd read in the old Saragossa manuscript and then Paul Christian's History and Practice of Magic and Arthur Edward Waite's Book of Black Magic and Pacts. Oh, boy. Well, so when I And of course, as most of you know, are familiar with my background, I was terribly ill. In fact, I was dying, and I was just absolutely. Oh, I was really on my last legs. I had an ulcer that I thought it was an ulcer. Actually, it was a gallbladder that had turned to solid rock. And I was jaundiced, and I was underweight, and I looked like a skeleton, and I was just really dying. But not only that, I was kind of nuts. And that's how I got into this. And so I was studying Tibetan tantric yoga and books on Fudan and even a little bit of Jung, and so my approach to this was a combination of this and these old things like the Arthur Edward Waite's Book of Black Magic and Pacts, which was a synthesis of a number of medieval and quasi-medieval grimoires. So I was definitely one of these old school magicians. I mean, this like this revival more recently, but no, I was. That's the way I started out. My circle was made from a cable reel top, and I had it all painted up, and then I had I was burning incense, and I was doing these spirits, with them. Burning their sigils with the curse of chains and doing all this medieval stuff. I mean, or what I, thought was medieval stuff. And really taking all of this medieval approach very seriously. And I didn't get into the Golden Dawn and into very much Crowley or anything like that until after I had already done this, after I'd already had my magical epiphany, as it were. So, I can really sympathize with these people like Joe Lichefsky and Stephen Skinner and Rankin and these guys who have been coming out with these books, and Joe Peterson, have been coming out with these books about where they're basically saying, oh, let's get back to the old stuff, let's be authentic. And I can really sympathize with that. I can really get with that. That resonates with me, and so I like them, and I buy all their books, of course, naturally, and I even read their books, which is more than most people. The publishers will tell you that most people who buy these magic books don't even read them. They just look at the pictures and stick them on the shelf, and you go, oh boy, this looks neat. But I'm a great fan of Stephen Skinner and Joe Lichefsky and Alan Rankin and all that. I love their stuff and I recommend it highly. But there's a few things about this revival of the old school that we need to kind of get straight, I think, in the practice of magic and actually doing it. I mean, actually doing this old Solomonic magic. And this is something that gets kind of complex, but I think we need to sort it out. Now, especially for the benefit of people who want to learn how to do this and actually do this work and they want to learn to do it. Now, so... essentially, what the old system magicians are kind of trying to tell us, they're trying to tell us that all this Golden Dawn stuff and all this Victorian bric-a-brac and this Masonic-type occultism, and of course they include the OTO and Crowley in this, all of this is not really necessary for magic, and it actually gets in the way of magic, and we need to get back to the original grimoires and the original and do it the way the original grimoire tell you to do it. And you need that medieval mindset. And of course, Joe Lichefsky, he he has to admit that the best thing for you to do if you follow his system is to go back and rejoin the Catholic Church and be sure you go to Mass every Sunday. And well, that's not a bad idea, but that's so you have that power, you know, the power of God and belief on your side. That's good, and that is medieval. That's definitely medieval, because one thing we have to say about the medieval mindset, regardless of how wise and literate some of their magicians were back in the Middle Ages, the mindset of the time was very, very, very devout, very, very devoted to God. I mean, these people, God, the church, was the center of their lives. And the church was had the power of life and death. And I remember when I took a course years ago in college, and I took a course called Christianity and Western Thought, which was taught by a minister, a PhD from Yale. And he opened the class with a question to all the students. And he said, why, in the Middle Ages, when these people were poor, they were miserable, they were illiterate, they were old at 40, their life expectancy was very short, and their infant mortality rate was way up, and they were living in misery. Why did they build these beautiful, magnificent cathedrals? Why did they spend their effort and their resources and their treasure on building these huge cathedrals that were masterpieces of architecture and art? Why did they? And of course he asked the question. It was a rhetorical question. And yeah, and all the students, you know, they knew they weren't supposed to answer it. They were waiting for him to answer it, of course, and so we all waited for him to answer it. And so then he said, because they believed in God. Well, that really defines the Middle Ages. They believed in God, and they believed in the devil, and they believed in the demons, and they believed in the angels, and they believed in all of this, and they believed it was absolutely real, and they believed that heaven and hell were just as real and just as inevitable as death and taxes. And consequently, this was the generative power, the psychodynamic power, if you will, that gave the punch to medieval magic. Now, because of that, it was very possible for these magicians in those days to operate in what I like to call campfire magic. Now, campfire magic works this way. Way back when we first became human beings, and you know, back in Cro-Magnon days, back 30, 40, 50,000 years ago, we were out there in the woods in the night, and we had a campfire. And that little campfire, those of you who've been Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts, you know this experience. You're way out in the woods, you got the campfire, and beyond the campfire is the darkness. And oh boy, in that darkness you've got saber-toothed tigers and great huge cave bears, and you've got all kinds of awful things, and wolves that are almost as big as a horse, and yeah, you know, you really got out there in the darkness is some pretty bad stuff. But the fire is a circle of protection, and you sit there around the fire and warming your front and freezing your back, and sit there around the fire, and you start telling stories. And the bard, you know, of course, it's in the old days, the bard or the shaman, he tells the stories, and then you see the eyes reflected around the fire and of the animals, and oh, you know, then you have to,
you have to get the spears out, and then you take a firebrand, of course, and you hold that firebrand because you know the animals are afraid of fire. This is campfire magic. The magic circle is the campfire. Yeah, and outside that magic circle are the demons. Oh yeah. Okay, so that's this primordial type of magic, which we find, by the way, in the Key of Solomon, which is, we don't have any versions of it much earlier than 1500s, but it is a medieval grimoire, so this is the kind of idea. And Joe Lichevsky, he likes to get back to this, and I think that's a great idea. That's a great idea. Let's get there. And he uses the Heptameron, which really is a medieval grimoire, and it doesn't have a spiritus locus or some place to put a conjuration device. It doesn't. It does this sort of thing, see? Campfire magic. And so Joe says, squat in the woods, get your bare feet in the middle of the night. And then you set up your four big candles, and you got your smoke going, and I'll bet you it'll work. We've done some stuff at night out in the henge, it's a good feeling, it's a good idea. And the idea of putting your feet on the dirt, that's a good idea too. I think I'd like to try one of Joe's Heptameron operations, but of course. We live in the middle of a national forest, and I happen to know that we got bears out there, and I happen to know that we got some mountain lions out there, and I'm not so sure I want to go way, way back up in the hills to do this. I think I'm going to stay in my yard. It might be better. But this is good. This will work, and this is fine. Now, however, I want to point out a few things here. That, granted, this old-style idea will work. And it'll work indoors, too. Now, Steve Savdo proved that. And we had Steve on, a couple weeks ago. Steve Savdo proved that. He decided that putting a mirror in a triangle, that was sissy stuff, and he wasn't going to do that. So he did it the hard way, and what he would like to think was the medieval way. I'm going to take some difference in that in a minute, but let's say he did it medieval style. Okay, so he got inside a closed room and he put the triangle out there, and he put it two feet off and 3 feet over, just like you're supposed to. But he stood it up on a 3 foot table, put it flat, and then conjured, and he used the curse of chains, and he used all, and he cooked sigils, he did all this stuff, and then finally got the demons to appear over the triangle. Yeah, all right, he did. Now, he did, and I know he did. I know Steve, and I know he did, and I know he wasn't fooling. Oh, he only did it about six times, and it was very hard, and very hard on him. And it took a tremendous amount of effort but at least they achieved visual contact, and they achieved knowledge of conversation. Now, granted, I think Steve admits they couldn't photograph it, but it looked like it was good enough. Manifested sufficiently enough to where you would have thought it could have been photographed. But this actually, there are two things about what Steve did that were really not medieval, because for one thing, the Goetia it was conceived in medieval times, but it didn't start being practiced until the Renaissance, and the important thing to realize about it is that the Goetia originally was intended to be used with a conjuration device. And a conjuration device is, of course, a dark mirror. And this, by the way, surprisingly enough, came about in the Middle Ages. And there's an exception to every rule. Well, not so much, because you have to understand that even though, and I've explained the medieval mindset fairly well, and I think you understand where these people are coming from, what they believe and how they believe it and all of that and why they believe that way. Now, here's the thing, though. Magicians in the Middle Ages were very well-educated and very, very erudite people. They were usually clerics, and because the church had the monopoly on learning, of course. So these fellows had a church background, and they're fluent in Latin and probably in Greek, and they also had access. They had access to an Arabic grimoire that was a synthesis of all of the magic that was current in the Arab world, currently being used in the Arab world, and they had access, because the Arabs had access to everything back to Alexandria, including the Hermetic treatises and everything else. So this grimoire that they had, a great big book called the Picatrix, and this was available in Latin. This was available to medieval magicians in the late 1100s. That's during the High Crusades and all that, so you can't get any more medieval than that. Okay, so, and there was the Picatrix, as much as it's full of all kinds of nasty stuff, and there's all kinds of dark stuff in the Picatrix, and good stuff too, but the Picatrix is a hermetic grimoire. I mean, it's really a hermetic grimoire, and these medieval magicians, they really did understand it, and they used it, and the man who was the grandfather of the Galatia, and we'll get into that in a minute, was steeped in the Picatrix. And he was an astrologer, and he was also an expert on Dante, and of course the Galatians, spirit structure and angel structure, oh, that's all Dante-esque. That's all based on Dante. It's not the cliff art. See, one of the things that Steve decided to do, and it's okay, he could do this. It is perfectly all right. He put all of his Goetic spirits in the Cliffoth. Well, that's not where they go. That's not where they go, because his Goetic, the real Goetia derives not from the Kabbalah, although it uses the Kabbalah, the Renaissance version, but it really comes from the Picatrix, and it really comes through Secobit and Dioscoli, who is the grandfather of it. And, however, I want to read you something right quick from the Picatrix here, so you'll understand where we're coming from here. Now, here we are. Imagine now I'm the Moor. You know, the Picatrix was supposedly written by the Moor, and the Moor was an anonymous Spanish-Arab sorcerer who is referred to as Almagriti, the Moor. Okay, this is the Moor talking. Here we will answer a certain unspoken question. That is, in what way devils exist in fire? The jinn, of course, devils in fire. I say that man is called a lesser world, and when comparing him to the greater, one may almost say that whatever is contained in the greater world may be found virtually in the lesser. Thus, if the jinn exist in the greater world, they ought to, in a certain sense, be found in the lesser. Okay. Now you're beginning to see. So this so-called medieval mindset, even though it is all-pervading in the medieval mind, the magicians, on the other hand, and especially our friend Secco de Ascoli, they were actually steeped in an Arabic version of Hermetic philosophy. Uh-huh. Are you getting this over in Singapore, Stephen? Is this coming through? I hope so. Now, I would like to, at this point, because we're talking about Hermetic philosophy in relation to this, I'd like to read a little bit of Hermes Direct, because this was what was coming through in the Renaissance to confirm what we had in the Picatrix. Now, just listen to this. And this, of course, is the words of Hermes Trismegistus. For the daemons mould our souls into another shape and pull them away to themselves, being seated in our nerves and marrow and veins and arteries, and penetrating even to our inmost organs. For at the time when each one of them, for each one of us is born and made alive, the daemons, who are at that moment on duty as ministers of birth, take charge of us. That is, the daemons who are subject to some one planet. For the planets replace one another from moment to moment, and they do not go on working without change, but succeed one another in rotation. And these daemons then make their way in through the body and enter into two irrational parts of the soul, and each daemon perverts the soul in a different way according to his special mode of action. All right, that's Hermes Trismegistus Direct. All right, now that's pretty close to what we just read in the Picatrix, isn't it? So, here we have, in 1320, or thereabouts, in sunny Italy, we have an astrologer who is also a published author on astrology and on various matters of philosophy, a man known as Cecco di Ascoli. Now, Cecco di Ascoli was also a magician, and Cecco di Ascoli, well, he liked Dante, but he felt like he wanted to do a satire on Dante, and that did not please the church too much, because the church was really into Dante, of course, and Dante was dogma, virtually. So they were looking askance at Cecco. Cecco was a wonderful Hermetic astrologer. He was steeped in Ptolemy, and he of course he was a magical astrologer, and they were a little leery of some of his astrological ideas too, because they were a little too magical. Now, Cecco di Ascoli wrote a commentary on the Sphere of Trabasco, which was a book at the time. So he wrote a commentary on it, and he published the commentary. Now, in this commentary that Cecco published on this book, The Sphere, he decided to recount how he had summoned a goetic demon under the rulership of King Amaemon. Does that sound familiar? And this goetic demon claimed to have fallen from the ranks of the cherubim. And this goetic demon appeared to Cecco in the magic mirror and gave him all sorts of very interesting information, which he also recounted. Now, so Cecco published this. And he got invited to go over to Florence and be interviewed by the church on it. And he went over to Florence, and of course, and as this discussion was going on with the doctors of the church, they began to ask him some very, very, very leading questions. And of course, Cecco got upset, and he said, "Well, I didn't expect an Inquisition." And of course, at that moment, several Dominicans in black robes and hoods came in and grabbed him, and they told him, "No one expects the Inquisition." And there he was. And they took his book, and he took his, well, I don't know what they did with his mirror, but they took his book, and they took him. And after, the comfy chair and the soft pillows and all, they burned him, Cecco, and his book at the stake. Well, 1326 AD, year of our Lord, Anno Domini, 1326. high Middle Ages, okay? And here goes the grandfather of the Goetia, burned at the stake. Now, his book, however, many copies, or several copies, escaped. And so, this became the secret was out. If they hadn't known it before, well, they had known it before, because, actually, you see, back to the old Picatrix, where old Sekko cut his teeth, and where this whole thing started, at least in the Middle Ages, back to the Picatrix. And where are we here? And I have to read you this, because this one ought to put the cap on it right here. Now, let's see. 287, yeah. All right. If you happen to have a copy of Michael Greer and Chris Warnock's Picatrix, then you might want to follow me in this. And this is page 267 and 268. And let's keep on here, 267 and 268. Wait a minute. All right, here we go. Okay, now, in Picatrix, the Moor says, in a certain book edited by Geber the Sage concerning tempests and other things, I found this written. Make a mirror of gold or gilt silver and suffumigate it with the hair from a woman's chest. Which you moisten with your semen and then suffumigate it with threads from her garment. And after you have washed yourself, look into it. And you will make her image appear in the mirror, followed immediately by yours. Or first, then hers. Or yours first, and then hers. And this experiment is something that Ptolemy of Babylon said. Must have been another Ptolemy. And three sages from India found it in Egypt, and they proved that this mirror ought to be made when the moon is in conjunction with Jupiter and gilded and furbished when the moon is in Venus. But I wish to tell you of the composition of the mirror and how it will be worked and kept for this reason. And for that, all the nature of humanity enters into it. Temper the mirror with live and natural blood, then succumigate it, then write on it the names of the seven stars and the seven symbols, and the names of the seven angels and the seven winds, and now the names of the seven stars are these. And I'm not going to... Well, you're going to have to go out and buy the book if you want to get these secrets. And the figures are written in a circle around the outer edge, and they are in a ring, and next are written within a polished and gilded circle the names of the seven angels. You'll have to get those in the book too. And when this is done, the names of the seven winds are written on an unpolished part, and there are the powers of the winds. Whose names are these? And again, we'll make that secret. And I'm selling... Michael Greer and Chris Warnock, now I'm selling some books for you here. Then suspend the mirror for 7 days in silk above water and suffumigate it, and let it be suspended from the red staff, and for 3 nights suffumigate it with good odors and the best that may be found in the book of Moses. And if you gaze into this mirror and keep it well, you will see that which is in you, and will gather men, wind, spirits, demons, the dead, and the living, and all will obey you and be at your command. Do your work in this manner. The suffumigation is of the seven things proper to man, that is, blood, semen, spittle, earwax, the tears of the eyes, feces, and urine. Suffumigate with this, and instruct the winds as you wish, and they will do your will, and keep this, and you will experience all that I have said to you, for you will have the power over winds, men, and demons, and they will come immediately to you and do this over a basin of water, over some other clean vessel full of water, and you will behold this, and it will be fulfilled as you have asked. Oh, boy. Now, This was very, very, very important, and every magician worth his salt had a copy of this. So, even though there may have been some magicians who did it like Steve did it, and, you know, and did it over the triangle like that, but this is what the guys who knew what they were, you know, what they wanted to do, and were steeped in the literature of magic, did all the way from Secco d'Ascoli's originally, even before that, perhaps, but certainly after Secco died, and then, of course, that made it famous or infamous. And they, you can tell by reading Secco's whole rigmarole and what he did, and the Picatrix, you know beyond any doubt that what goes in that mirror. What goes in the triangle in the Goetia, especially in Psalm 2731, is a magic mirror. Yeah, that's what goes in there. All right? Now, Aaron Lettich, bless his heart, who is otherwise a great scholar and a good magician and all that. He has a thing about this. He doesn't want to have that mirror, and he just doesn't want to have it. So he makes statements like, well, all the manuscripts have the circle just white. They don't show a black circle. Well, only thing that Aaron's looking at are the published versions, which have that mirror whited out. All of the manuscript versions have the mirror is all solid black in the triangle, or it's cross-hatched in all of them. Of course, everyone also said that the semi-amphorax had no relation to the Goetia, too, but then, of course, most of the Goetic magicians, including Tom Rudd, put the versicles from the semi-amphorax right on the back of the corresponding Goetia sigils. So Aaron's wrong there, too. But the point being here that I'm making is that regardless of whether campfire magic is more medieval, mirror magic was also medieval, and the reason why it was not written down specifically, put a mirror in this triangle, the reason why I didn't do that is because of what happened to Secco. Mirrors had a very, very, very dark reputation. So a magician really didn't want to write down in his grimoire that that's what you were going to do. So what he did was he either didn't write it and showed it, you know, they used terms like glass receptacle. Of course, that usually refers to the poor man's crystal ball. That's a jar full of water. But there was no problem now there's no problem whatsoever in crystal, using crystals. No, they were angelic. I mean, a crystal ball, that's fine. That's angelic. That's wonderful. And you can write about that. Oh, yeah, you can. But even though you're going to write about evocation, you better not mention a mirror. Remember what happened to Secco d'Ascoli? We all remember that, don't we? And we don't want that to happen. Because even after the Catholic Church, you know, after the Reformation and everything else, that was still a kind of a trauma. Here's a man who gets burned to death because he summons a spirit in a mirror. And so I want to make this very, very clear because now, by the way, Joe Wachowski, even though he loves to do this heptameron thing using campfire magic, which is great, and as I said, I think we ought to go out and try that sometime, and you know, without getting the bears angry, maybe. But Joe Wachowski, in his latest book, Howling is from the Pit, and this is a pretty neat book, actually. I kind of recommend it. I think, you know, it's old school magic kind of thing. But toward the end of the book, he admits that his most significant magical experience was staring at his reflection in the Mirror of Solomon. in a dark room with the candles and staring at this in the Mirror of Solomon. Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. So Joe's not against this either. Now, Pell, I want to make this clear that even though there is the medieval mindset is somewhat different than the Renaissance mindset. Now, let's talk about the difference in that mindset. In the early days of the Renaissance in Italy, the Hermetic treatises in their original, well, one of their later original forms, became available, and Carlo de Medici sponsored or patroned Ficino, Marsilio Ficino, to translate them. And he wanted those before Plato. They had Plato, too. And Carlo de Medici said, I want the Hermetic treatises first. They were more important than Plato. So they were translated and by Ficino. And this, because the general opinion was that these Hermetic treatises were earlier than Christianity, and there's so much, you know, in the Hermetic treatises, there is so much of esoteric Christianity, dovetails with esoteric Christianity. Now, the church, the theology of the church, as our friend Joe Farrell points out, Joe Farrell, by the way, is an alchemist, and we hope to have him on the show, you know, for too much longer. He's written a book called The Philosopher's Stone, among others, which is really good. Joe has a degree in patristics. He has a PhD in patristics from Oxford, I believe. And patristics is the study of the writings of the church fathers. That's how Joe got into alchemy. Because he discovered, when he's reading about the church fathers, and he's reading their work, that they were Neoplatonic. And Neoplatonism is the operative philosophy of Hermeticism. In fact, you could describe Hermeticism, really. You could say it's Gnostic cosmology on a Neoplatonic base. That's a quick and dirty definition of Hermetic philosophy. So these church deans, the intellectuals of the Catholic Church, they liked Hermes. They liked him basically because they thought he was pre-Christian. And so you could write Hermetic books, and you could write books about Hermetic magic. And there was there for about 100 years, we had a wonderful period where ceremonial magic became the art of the highest philosophers. It was highly respected. It was considered to be the epitome of practical philosophy. And you had people like Pico della Mirandola, and you had and Campanella, and of course Ficino, and all these doing, resurrecting the Orphic hymns and doing all this kind of stuff based upon the church's acceptance of Hermes Trismegistus. So this became the Renaissance mindset toward magic. Became openly and intensely Hermetic. Whereas before, the Hermetic treatises had filtered through the Picatrix, and only a few magicians were really, you know, cognizant of the whole thing, like Pseco and people like that. But now we had a brief shining hour, and then, of course, a philologist, that's another word for a linguist, linguistics expert, proved that the particular treatises that Ficino had translated were actually post-Christian. They weren't pre-Christian. Well, actually, earlier versions of the same thing were pre-Christian, but Ficino happened to get versions of them that were written down, or at least written down post-Christian periods. So consequently, the church had to accept the fact that this was pagan philosophy. They had to accept that fact. So consequently, Hermes went out of favor with the intellectuals of the church. Now, they even had statues of Hermes in the courtyards of some churches. And, of course, naturally, those statues had to be pulled down and broken up. You know, sort of like pulling down Saddam Hussein's or Stalin's statue, you know, crash, bang, down they came. And then, if you wrote a book on Hermetic magic, you could not get an imprimatur. And, as Giordano Bruno found out the hard way, you could get burned at the stake. Oh, yeah. So, we had a brief shining hour there but the cat was out of the bag as far as philosophy is concerned. So Renaissance magic does then take an openly Hermetic view. Now, how does that relate to where we are at in relation to this old school magic? Well, what it means basically is this. That, yes, you can use that mirror in the triangle, because, of course, that's what they did, and you certainly use it. But, you know, when you see your face change and become, you know, turn into the spirit and all of that, you're, in modern terms, which Crowley is partially responsible for, in modern terms, this becomes some sort of a psychological process and a physical illusion and then a psychological process here, and you're seeing some aspect of yourself. And Crowley set Skinner's teeth on edge, certainly, by making the statement in the 1904 edition of the Goetia that the Goetic spirits are simply portions of the human brain. Well, this was kind of a dumb statement on Crowley's part, because they're not portions of the human brain. They're portions. They are related to aspects of the human mind. Now, the human mind is like the software, and the brain is the hardware. And you know, if you're going to use a computer analogy, so we're not talking about some kind of bioelectric synapse here. We're talking about, and if Crowley had thought a little bit, he wouldn't have said that. What we're really talking about is something in, and remember now, we'll go back to Hermes now, because Hermes said this. We go back that these demons all come down, and they're part of us, but they have a universal quality to them. They are larger. They not only come down from the stars and the planet, they have a universal quality. They represent a universal force. And as such, they have tremendous power. Because they're like a colony animal. They exist in everybody. And then beyond everybody. And so when you plug into them, oh boy, you find the power. And you really will find the power. Now, however, because of Crowley's statement, and because of later prejudice against Jung, and by the way, Jung was very Hermetic, and Jung himself was steeped in Hermeticism, and he did several books on alchemy, and Jungian philosophy is very, very, very similar in relation to Hermetic. So is Tibetan Tantric High Vehicle Buddhism. It's almost identical. The only difference between High Vehicle Tantric Buddhism and Hermetic philosophy is that we believe everything is reality and they believe everything is illusion, but other than that, I mean, you know, it's just about the same. And because some people don't like Jung, and they have their reasons, and I'm not going to go into those reasons, they're cultural. They don't like Jung. And therefore, they don't really like Hermetism that much, Hermetic philosophy that much, but they still like magic. And they're kind of fishing around for some kind of a philosophy to pin it on, and they pay lip service to the Hermetic philosophy, which magic is really based on, but they don't. And you got to realize, though, when you look at this, that... The idea here of staring at your face in the mirror and your reflection in this mirror, this kind of forces you to realize that whatever shows up in that mirror, you have a personal connection to. no matter what it looks like, no matter what it says, no matter how far out it is, you have a personal connection. Now, medieval magicians had no problem with this. Well, some of them did, because even El Khaldun, one of the Arab commentators, he said, they think that a mist forms between them and the mirror, and the image in the mirror, and that the apparition appears in this mist. Okay, if you want to think that, that's for the people that aren't into Hermetic philosophy, see, if you want to think that. So, if somebody who's not into Hermetic philosophy, and you put them in front of the mirror, then okay. Mist forms between the magic mirror and them, and they see it there. Or you can do that if you want. But, if you are steeped in Hermetic philosophy, and even if you are otherwise medieval in your mindset, and you buy into Ptolemy's astrology, you know, geocentric astrology, all the rest of that, which we do, you know, for working purposes, and all of that, and even if we go out on Saturday afternoon and put up the tent and bang on each other with rattan swords until our ears ring, no matter what we, you know, Frater Tyron hit me so hard with one of those rattan swords. I had this Freon helmet on, you know, that's back when I was in the SCA. He hit me upside the head with the rattan sword so hard that I was hearing, my ears were ringing for a week. Yeah, so I don't know about that. I think the next, if I go back to reenacting the Middle Ages, I think I'm going to try to be a monk. But the problem with that is that the SCA doesn't want a church. They want the Middle Ages, but they don't want a church. We had one of our guys, an SCA guy, who was one of our people, Frater Johannes, who tried to start an SCA church, and he just wanted to just go around and do mummery and whatever, and swing censers and mumble a lot of stuff, and just put on a kind of a church that would look churchy. But they didn't like that. They didn't want it. The medieval mindset is if you want to have that, that's great. I think it's very romantic. Well, just don't try to be like they really were in the Middle Ages, for heaven's sake. There's a great book on that, by the way. Those of you old school magicians, those of you who want to go out and cut your wand like Harry Potter's wand, you want to go out and cut your wand on the first day of April and the hour of Jupiter and find a birch that's never been breached find a virgin birch and Joe Lachevsky found the virgin birch, and he looked for a whole year, he found the virgin birch, and then he made a mistake and put his hand on it. But you're supposed to cut the wand off with putting your hand on it, and Joe made a mistake. He was so happy to find the birch, he put his hand on it. So then he had to wait for a whole another year and find another virgin birch. But if you want to do that, that's fine. Well, what I suggest you do is get a book by Ian Mortimer, and you can get it from the Science Fiction Book Club, called A Time Traveler's Guide to the 14th Century. And then you will find out just what it's like to live in the Middle Ages, and oh boy. So you don't want to create... You don't want to go that far, believe me. But idealizing it is fine. It's very romantic. That's what we did in Victorian times, anyway. So, as I say, I'm all for old school magic. I got started that way myself. To get back to this business of the mirror, if you really don't want to look at your own face in that mirror, if you can't, but that, you know, that's what they did, and that's how they did it, and whatever. But if you don't want to do it that way, then use a Bardonian mirror. Just put a black surface, and visualize on it. But that's, you know, that's good. But they don't like. But the new, the old system magic people, they don't even like Bardon. They don't like Bardon. They don't like Randolph. And, of course, they don't like Crowley. I don't know whether they like me or not, but they haven't, you know, they apparently don't like the idea of putting a mirror in the triangle, which, of course, kind of eliminates the best of the Galatia for them. Well, but now maybe after we explain all of this, perhaps they'll understand that it really is medieval, and maybe they'll, you know, maybe they'll be able to realize that. But all told and all considered, the old school magic has produced some wonderful, wonderful resources for us all. You know, Stephen Skinner and Alan Rankin's books are just beautiful. And, you know, there's a few things in them that, you know, that, a few things I disagree with. But then again, my gosh, they're just beautiful pieces of work, and they're very good to have. And the same thing with Joe Lachevsky. Even though, you know, Joe gets a little arch and a bit too, perhaps a little bit too dogmatic, but then, you know, you can forgive him that. But basically, they all agree, all of them agree, that these manifestations are actually subjective, and none of them that I know of are trying to claim that you can photograph these spirits, and if they did, they wouldn't, you know. But let me say this. If that sounds like I'm saying, oh, it's just your imagination, well, remember, the imagination is the most powerful force in the universe, the human imagination. You are a representative of God, and your imagination is what creates. And so the idea that it's just your imagination is something that results from Rene Descartes, and that's something else I just want to mention before we get through with this. That in the Middle Ages, they really didn't have too much problem with imagination versus hard reality or hard physical reality. They didn't have a problem because before Descartes, before Rene Descartes in the Renaissance, there wasn't any clear line drawn between what you could imagine and what was physically there. But Descartes was the man who, and the scientific community just loved this because this helped them launch the scientific movement, was Descartes was the man who said, well, if you can't measure it, you can't feel it, you can't measure it, you can't see it, you can't replicate it, it doesn't exist. It's not real. It has no reality, and therefore it has no worth. Okay? That was a low water mark for spirituality in the West. But it launched the scientific process. And so on the one hand, it set us on the road to technological progress, but it restricted our spiritual progress. Now, we are the people today who are desperately looking for some sort of magical miracle are the ones who are suffering from what Descartes inflicted upon us. And you should understand that in magic you need to get beyond Descartes. You need to realize that what you see, what you visualize, has its own reality and its own importance, and it can be just as important, just as inspiring, and just as dangerous as something that was physically real. And you have to get around that. This takes some mental conditioning, and it takes a certain amount of understanding, because what Descartes inflicted on us really, really deprived us of our appreciation of the spiritual. So I have a lot of sympathy for people who don't want to realize the subjectivity of these operations. They want to do them, and they want to have somehow or other convince themselves that the spirit is so-called, quote, real, unquote. All right. Let me put it this way. Evans Wentz, when he was collecting fairy tales and fairy lore, way back in the 20s, he found this old Irish peasant, and he asked him, he said, well, have you ever seen any fairies? And the old peasant, I see the fairies, I see the little people, you know them, yeah. And So Wentz asked him, he said, well, do you think I could photograph them? And then the old Irish peasant gave him a kind of a wry look. And he said, well,
they might, if they let you, maybe you could, if they let you.
So if you want to look at it that way, you just figure, okay, well, I'm seeing the spirit here, and if he wants me to, maybe I can photograph him, and if I photograph him and he doesn't show us, because he doesn't want me to. You can look at it that way if you want to. But personally, I don't need to play that kind of a trick on myself, because I know that what I see in visions, and what I see in what I visualize, and what I communicate with, I know that it has a vast and transcendental reality. And I know I know that. But then again, on the other hand, you know, I'm going to cut my teeth on hermetic philosophy. So, and that in its own way is a medieval mindset. Oh, yeah. Yeah. So I guess maybe when I said I started off as an old school magician, old system magician, I guess I still am. So let's hear it for the old school. And those of you who are interested in this particular issue and all of that, I very much recommend those books that we've been talking about, and you'll find them fascinating. And so, and next week, and in honor of Halloween coming, and all, we're going to get into a subject that, of course, fascinates people around Halloween and other times too, and whatever, vampires. So we're going to delve into vampire lore. And meanwhile, I will see you next week, and good magic.